Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscowane has the day off today. Political polls and election season go hand in hand, and in an election cycle like none other, in which the numbers seem to shift on a near weekly basis, we're going to touch base this hour with some polling experts to find out what they're doing to gauge the mood of the electorate. Who are they reaching out to? How are they conducting surveys? Landlines have fallen out of favor with most of us. And is it even possible to give an accurate snapshot if the narrative changes seemingly from one day to the next? How do you use political polls? Do the results factor into how you'll vote on Election Day? Here's the number, 888-477-9499. You can send an email along to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Joining us now for some insight, Sam Wong is a data analyst and neuroscience professor at Princeton University. He's also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Welcome to Radio Times, Sam.
Thank you for having me on today.
And Chris Borick is a professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. And great to have you back with us, Chris.
Thanks, Mary.
So out this weekend, a couple of new polls taken on the state and national levels. And Chris, we'll go to you first. We've got a new Morning Call Muhlenberg College poll, which shows a real tightening of the race in Pennsylvania. Clinton, apparently, according to the poll, is still ahead of Trump, only by a 3% margin, though, 44% to 41%. And Chris Borick, just a week earlier, the gap was much wider. Hillary Clinton, 47%, Donald Trump, 38%. So could you parse those numbers for us?
Yeah, Mary, it was to me, it was a surprise to see the numbers move that much. We don't usually see in our polls and a lot of polls within a week movement on a presidential race on the level we did. So some of it might be a little bit because of our last week's poll being a bit on the outlier side, and it came back to the mean a little bit this week. And it's also a week that I think if you look at our internals in our poll, that we saw some movement away from third-party candidates in the form of Gary Johnson and towards Donald Trump. It seemed that at least our poll last week, we saw bigger than a lot of other polls support for Gary Johnson. And this week that came back considerably, and it looks like a lot of those voters tend to be in the direction of Donald Trump. And that might play into or be part of Trump's narrative, on safety, order, security. Last week was a week with a terrorist attack. It had some riots in the streets of Charlotte, and it's certainly for people that might be predisposed to vote Republican already helped move the needle a little bit in that direction.
Sam Wong, what's your take?
I think it's hard to tell with a single poll, no matter how well conducted, which direction the true movement is. If you look at the last 10 polls, two of which are from Muhlenberg Morning Call in Pennsylvania, in those 10 polls, Clinton leads Trump in all 10 of them. And so I think it's really hard to detect a lot of movement. If you look at national polls, again, aggregating lots of them, statistically it looks like in the last few weeks things maybe have moved towards Donald Trump by 1, maybe 2 percentage points. And so I think that it is a difficult thing to say. Pennsylvania is obviously essential for the presidential election. But I would say that currently signs indicate that that these two polls from Muhlenberg are 2 out of 10 polls that all point in the same direction. Mm.
Well, and speaking of national polls, there is a new Quinnipiac poll out. I saw some of the numbers today. Hillary Clinton, 44%. Donald Trump, 43%. So are you saying, Sam Wong, that perhaps voters should not take any one poll but kind of look at the aggregate?
I think it's tough. Right now, so just to step back a little bit, the last 20 years have seen severe polarization of voters where campaigns don't change very much during the season and the races are often fairly closely divided. So my take on this is that any single poll might accidentally give you a result that looks like one candidate is leading when, in fact, on Election Day, the other will. So what would be better would be to take, say, go to Huffington Post or Real Clear Politics and look at the last 3 surveys and say, okay, well, 2 show Clinton ahead, 1 shows Trump ahead, which one is in the middle of the three values. And that middle one is probably where things are at. And that's, you know, it takes a little bit more time, but it gives a more accurate read on where things are at.
Right. So the tone of this presidential campaign might well be described as mercurial, especially when compared with the election of 2012, incumbent Barack Obama and Republican Mitt Romney. Let's begin by talking about the unique challenges this might present for political pollsters. Chris Bork, you know, what are some of the main challenges in trying to get your arms around an election such as this one?
Oh, there's lots of challenges, Mary. And I'll just quickly touch on what Sam said. I'm, you know, as much as I think our poll has been a good poll and we do things right and transparently, I'm a fan of aggregation myself. I'd rather see a number of polls and take those overall directions. I think it's more data points, and on the whole, I think that's a good way to approach how you're looking at where the races are headed. On an individual pollster level, someone that's in the field doing this, there's lots of challenges. It's trying to get a handle on likely voters, trying to get a handle on changing patterns of communication within our society. You mentioned in your introduction the decline of landlines, for example, and the onset of cell phones within the process. How we reach people is a challenge. We've seen, you know, in our field, very steep declines in response rates among people that we try to interview. We've seen challenges in getting people to be as representative as a population in whatever population we're looking at. There's plenty of challenges out there to the industry as a whole right now, and I think almost every election cycle, as individual pollsters, we hold our breath a little bit to think, is this a year where some of these challenges might catch up to us in terms of our ability to accurately gauge elections?
Well, I've read that the response rates are down to about 9%. Is that accurate, Chris?
Yeah. If you look at Pew, which does wonderful polling, I think most of their averages this year are right around 9%. Ours in our election surveys have been, I think our last one was around 12%. We do a little higher response rates by the kind of the industry standard that we calculate this in election years rather than our general surveys. But, those numbers are dramatically down. If we looked even 15, 20 years ago, they were in the high 20% mark up to 30% mark. So that's an issue. One of the magics, and Sam might be able to talk more about this, is in terms of the accuracy of the polls as a whole, as a body, even with this declining response rate, which is clearly a threat methodologically, the accuracy hasn't changed that much in terms of polling, which in some ways is a mystery and in some ways a godsend to the industry as we move forward.
Well, I'd like to get to accuracy, and we will in just a moment. But Sam, how do you feel? How critical is poll data to voters when making the decisions they want to need to make before they hit the voting booth?
That's a good question. I think there's not such great evidence that that polling has a heavy influence on people's behavior. I will say that in close states like Pennsylvania, polls seem to come right on pretty close to the eventual margin. In states that are real runaway victories for one candidate or the other, for instance, say Utah or Oklahoma for Republicans, Vermont or New York for Democrats, whoever is on top tends to overperform, and that certainly could be one possibility. There is that voters are demoralized by the fact that they're going to get trounced. It could also be that, in fact, pollsters exercise their craft to figure out who's on top, and it's not so critical to figure out the exact margin. So I think there's not such great evidence that polling moves voter behavior. It's a hard question to answer.
All right. Chris, let's get back to accuracy and the actual method of gathering data, just a little bit more into the whole landline cell phone thing. So Americans are increasingly cellular. The issue there as opposed to working with landlines is what for the pollster?
Well, the issue is representation in terms of the sample. If most Americans are using cell phones as their primary means of communication and might not even have a landline in their house, and especially that's demographically skewed towards younger individuals, urban areas, lots of population, specific parts of the population. If we're calling landlines only, it's an enormous problem in finding in respondents that are representative. And so most pollsters, well, I should say many pollsters, have turned increasingly to cell phones as part of their sample. That's not across the industry, and there's some reasons for that, both cost and legality. If you are using, for example, a pollster is using robocalls, taped messages as their means of polling individuals, they're not allowed to call cell lines based on the FCC rules. And so what they try to do to make up for that is they'll still call landlines, and if people respond that way, is to do some really aggressive weighting of their sample to try and bring it back to the population estimates that they're going after. That brings in a lot of assumptions, and we all wait, every pollster, and that's part of our process, part of our way of making our samples as representative as we can. But if you imagine talking to only landline folks and say you're trying to weight a young population and you get maybe 2 or 3% of your responses on landlines, people under 30, and you're using that to represent, 15% of the population once you wait. There's some big assumptions being made there.
Yeah, so that was my next question. Is one of your bigger challenges getting taking the pulse of, say, the millennial group in regarding the candidates?
Yeah, of course. It's a tough.
And do you think you're achieving that?
Well, I think if you do a little bit more work, you have a better chance of doing that, right? If you use cell phones in your process. So if we're using cell phones, a comparison, if I look at the individuals we contact via cell phone versus those that we contact via landline, they're dramatically different, right? They're younger. They tend to have different demographics across the board in terms of who they are. And so if I have those in, I'm not going to say naturally in our sample, but through our sampling process, I'm not going to have to, if I have a bigger portion of my sample in that group, perhaps my weighting won't have to be as extreme to match that group when I'm putting together my final numbers.
Sam Wong? Chris.
No, yeah, Maria. So I think that's, a lot of it is the process of how we're actually contacting individuals to begin with.
Online surveys, a good alternative, Sam?
Oh, yeah. I will say that just broadly, as someone who does not conduct polls but just consumes the work of people like Chris and puts it together, that I've been very impressed with the polling profession as a whole. And there are some pretty clever methods that have been developed. One of Chris's rivals, YouGov, is run by an organization – is run by people who have gotten pretty good at internet-based sampling. And if you look at the whole polling community, it's been actually kind of a fun time to watch them experiment with methods. And internet methods, when properly done, can seem to do a reasonably good job. I will say that, broadly speaking, polls have done pretty well in the primary season so far this year. And so the early indications are that as a community, they've done a good job.
All right. We're looking at the art of polling in an unpredictable election cycle. And after the break, we're going to talk about the strategy for tonight's presidential debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. Our guests are Sam Wong, data analyst and neuroscience professor at Princeton University. He is director of the Wong Lab, and he is also the founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. And Chris Bork is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. We are taking calls at 888-477-9499, and we'll get to the callers as well coming right up. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are in, of course, an election cycle, which is like none other, and we're talking about how pollsters are handling the challenge. Our guests include Chris Borick, a professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion, and Sam Wong is data analyst and neuroscience professor at Princeton University and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. So, tonight, of course, is a busy night for anyone in the polling profession, the first of three presidential debates between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. So strategy, Chris, first to you. How do you comprise the questions for something like this?
Yeah, it's interesting, as you said, it's going to be a highly viewed event, and how we're going to measure the effects, and try to deduce if the debates had any effect on the election, and that's always challenging, both in the short term and the long term. One of the things in terms of questions is how we're fielding. There's going to be some polling tonight that you'll see out there that is done in real time. Through putting together online samples and focus groups and others to try and track how people are rating the answers as they go along. So you'll see that on some networks and some other sources as a way of measuring how people are viewing it. There'll be a lot of polling this week. You saw a lot of polling, as you usually do, in the run-up, including ours and a group of other polls that came up both statewide and nationally in the onset of the debate as we rolled up into it this weekend. And you're going to see a ton of polling this week that tries to deduce if there was any movement and in which, if so, what direction.
And how long do you expect these numbers to actually provide an actual, a real snapshot of what voters are feeling and sensing following a debate, Chris?
Well, it's always a great question. How long does a poll's results have relevance, you know, at least in terms of predicting or showing what the public feels at any given time? And as you use that word, the famous word is snapshot, right, that we take snapshots of where we are at one time. And to some degree, I think that's true. And this is always a great question with debates, and I think there's some really valid arguments that they don't move the electorate nearly as much as we might give them credit for in the popular media and the rhetoric that goes around them. And so you might see, like you do with some events, a short bump and then a return to where the race was beforehand. This year, the one caveat I'll say, this year seems to be a little bit more turbulent than other years, a little bit more movement, I think that's the case. And therefore, I think people are going to be very interested to see just what kind of longer-term impact it might have on the race after the polls come out this week.
Yeah. Sam Wong, is that your take, that the debates perhaps don't move the needle as much as some might think?
Well, my take is a little bit contrasting. Let me just bring up a couple of points that might be of interest to people. First, let me put on the neuroscience hat for a second, which is that in terms of comparing two things, the time when you can most easily make a comparison between two things is when they're right next to each other. And the debate is the one time when you get to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump right next to each other. And so in past years, there's been some shift that has come immediately after the debate. Now, is that a real shift? One of the difficulties is that given the response rates that we were hearing about from Chris a few minutes ago, that honestly, response rates can change. And if you're just a little bit more enthusiastic about picking up the phone or staying on the phone because your person seemed to do a pretty good job, then you can imagine that could temporarily move numbers. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it moves what the result is going to be. I do think that the first debate is probably the biggest remaining event between now and November 8th where we get to see the effects of some major event on people's sentiments. And so I anticipate there's going to be some move. I will say statistically that I'm just going to inject right now at this point that actually the odd thing about this year's campaign is that broadly there's been relatively little movement in opinion. Despite all the drama and the unprecedented nature of this year's campaign, this has been in some ways statistically the most stable presidential race in 65 years
really?
Of polling.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's bizarre to say, but I say this and people usually don't believe me, but statistically it is really pretty steady.
Well, let's get into this, Sam. You say national polls are less accurate than state polls and do not reflect electoral college mechanisms, and Metamargin addresses this. So first of all, what is Metamargin?
Speaking my language. Let's see. So the Metamargin is a way of compiling state polls like the Muhlenberg poll and other polls to come up with a single statistical snapshot. And there's this quantity that I really like to talk about, the Metamargin, which is to take the state poll-based snapshot of the Electoral College and say, how much would all the polls have to shift in order to create a perfect toss-up where we really have no idea which candidate would win? Hmm. And so, for instance, the Meta margin this season has been mostly spending its time at Hillary Clinton leading Donald Trump by about 4%, meaning that's how much the polls would have to swing nationwide. Right now, the Meta margin is pretty close. It's at about 1.5 percentage points in favor of Hillary Clinton. So right now, at the moment, if the election today were today, we would be up late watching election returns.
All right.
So that's the Meta margin. But anyway, the point being that Meta margin actually has moved remarkably little this year compared with past elections.
All right. We've got lots of calls and comments coming in. So let's get to an email from Neil in Media. How are margins of error calculated? I think too much reporting leaves out a prominent mention and explanation of those margins. So the margin of error, how should voters perceive those, Chris Bork?
It's a great question and fundamental and a little more difficult than it might seem to explain. So there's a couple drivers for margins of error. The largest driver is that the size of the sample, right? As size of the sample goes up, your margin of error goes down. But it's not linear. It's the principle of a diminishing return. So if you, for example, interviewed 500 people compared to 1,000, the 1,000 survey respondent survey is not going to be twice as accurate by margin of error standards. So it's one principle. I get that question a lot to say, well, you know, if you double your size, you're going to have double the accuracy. That's not the case. There's also a lot of other factors that go into margin of error. First is if you're not doing a probability-based survey, in other words, and this gets a little tricky and into the science and the math of it, if you're not giving respondents in your population an equal chance of being part of your sample, there's questions about can you actually even calculate a margin of error for a poll? And there's questions on internet polls. And I think Sam's right. I'm very intrigued, and I see some really wonderful methodology going online, and it's going to be interesting to see how they perform. But actually applying margin of error to something like a YouGov poll, which have gigantic sample sizes, 3,000, 4,000, that's part of their value, is really tricky to use. And this will get really into the weeds, but things like weighting affect margin of error, that when you're doing sampling. So if you have to wait, we talked about this before, you really do aggressive weighting, that's going to shape your margin of error. So there's a lot of aspects for it. You should look at it. And by the way, there's two numbers that you read with margin of error. You usually say plus or minus 3.
Yeah.
And then there's a second part that people don't often look, and it says something like at the 95% level of confidence, which means plus or minus 3 if it's a good sample and all things being equal. But maybe 1 out of 20 times, just by random sample error, the actual margins are going to be outside that. So there's, I know that's really geeky and lots of different aspects about it, but it's a complicated process.
All right. Well, we've got a tweet from Colin who asks, are there data on the differences between real person polling and anonymous polling? For an example, people might be embarrassed to admit a choice, and automated phone polling would be interesting to know the percent of Republicans and Democrats who have embraced NomoRobo, which is, I guess, a system which blocks robocalls. So I think there are a couple of questions in there. Sam Wong, this kind of dovetails with a question that I have here. Are Trump supporters fully represented in polls? Are some respondents still afraid to say they'll vote for Donald Trump for fear of being seen as a racist, and can this skew the results?
Yeah, this is an interesting one because Trump's candidacy is so unusual. He's not really a regular candidate, and the fact that he hasn't really rejected white nationalists, and he seems to have some pretty vocal supporters who are pretty frankly racist, suggests that maybe it would be a little bit, you know, embarrassing to say to a live person that you'd support him. It turns out that those effects, if they do exist, are pretty small. There's something called the Bradley effect that's been studied a long time. Back when Tom Bradley, the African-American mayor of Los Angeles, underperformed his polls a little bit, and it emerged after some study by political scientist Dan Hopkins that broadly speaking, up till about 20 or 30 years ago, there was that effect. The differences are pretty small this year. So I would say there could be a difference, but it hasn't been huge. And as I mentioned, polls as a whole, combining live and automated polls, did pretty well during the Republican primaries. They captured Trump support pretty well. So it feels like if there is such an effect, if it is there, it's not more than, say, 1 or 2 percentage points, which actually it's a close race. So, could be interesting, but probably small.
We've got a lot of calls coming in here to this show, this particular edition of Radio Times. So Paul in Center City, let's go to you first. Hello, Paul.
Yes, hi. I was curious about how your guests are thinking about the role that turnout is actually going to play in this election, because, it's varied a lot over the past 3 or 4 election cycles. 2004 was a very favorable one for Republicans. 2008 and 2012 were better for Democrats. How are you guys thinking about trying to portray that this time around?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Paul. Chris Bork, a connection between polling numbers and turnout?
Oh, it's Paul raises a gigantic issue, and that's anticipating turnout and how we ultimately identify likely voters and who's going to show up, right? That's the target. Who's going to show up on Election Day, and how do we do that? And there's been dramatically different turnouts in terms of the electorate over different election cycles, and you have to try and target that. So how do you do it? Well, you try to measure, you of course look at historic numbers, you try to get a sense of what has happened in the past as you form your models. You look at voter interest. Some of the bellwether indicators are how closely people are following the race, how much attention they're giving to the race, how interested they are. So in terms of trying to target a likely voter and on an aggregate level turnout, you have to take into consideration a number of factors that give us leads, if you will, about where we might head. And it makes a ton of difference, by the way. I'll just give an example from Paul's question. In 2012, the Romney pollsters, who are good pollsters, folks like Neil Newhouse, had a different turnout model in their mind. And they were going with it in terms of the turnout, the percentage of white versus non-white individuals in the electorate. And they had more promising numbers for Romney throughout much of the campaign, different than what a lot of public pollsters and the Obama folks had, and it caused a lot of differences in terms of how people were perceiving the polls in that election cycle. So it's a big issue.
Sam, let's get go ahead, Sam Wong.
Yeah, I just wanted to interject here that turnout is a challenge in the ways that you just heard, but actually it's not on people's minds right now, but turnout's really tough to estimate in midterm elections. So right now, look, everybody's attention is focused on this presidential race. You cannot swing a dead cat. I do not favor swinging dead cats, but I'm just saying you can't swing a dead cat without hitting a conversation about the merits or demerits of these candidates. And so voter awareness is high, and it's really 2 years from now, I think the pollster's job is going to be harder. 2 years ago, it was harder. Presidential elections are a relatively favorable environment for performing polling, given that pollsters are working very hard to do their best.
Sam, has there been a scrambling of the electoral map in this campaign?
Very definitely not. So this is interesting. So one might imagine, with the very unusual events that have happened in this year's campaign, that the electoral map would be scrambled. But pretty much if Obama won a state by 2 points or more 4 years ago, then Hillary Clinton is up there. If Mitt Romney won a state by 2 points or more, then Donald Trump is up there. And if you look at year-to-year correlation, so there's this technical measure called correlation coefficient. It's just to ask overall which states are above or below average for Democrats and Republicans. If you take that correlation coefficient between consecutive elections, a big change was going from Kennedy in 1960 to Johnson in 1964, when Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act and upended the map more or less for racial reasons. But this year is a lot like 4 years ago. Trump seems to have lost some Republicans who don't think much of his particular approach or style. They may be coming back. And so despite the fact that Trump and Mitt Romney are such different people, basically they are different versions of appealing to the Republican base. And it gets back to polarization, which I mentioned, which is that people get entrenched. And it's pretty tough to move voters in the current environment.
So as the polling numbers go up and down, what does this mean if there hasn't been, a real change in the electoral map?
Well, what it means is that, there's a whole host of phenomena that seem to, of numbers that seem to say the same thing. So one thing is that the patterns of voting seem to be the same. So we have red states and blue states, the fact that we can say that. The amount of variation during a campaign is a fraction of what it used to be. The total amount of variation, the volatility this year, is like 1/6 what it was when Carter and Reagan ran against one another. Another example of that, this is that negative opinions about both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are very high, more for Trump than for Clinton. But there's been a general tendency to think poorly of the other party's candidate. And you know, if you think poorly enough of the other candidate, then you're not going to change your vote. And so what it amounts to is a fight that's over a narrower and narrower segment of votes. And my guess is that this is probably why the fight has gotten nastier and louder, because in order to get people's attention, you have to say nasty, loud things. And so I think that these it's funny, like the loud campaign and the quiet numbers seem to be linked with one another.
Mm. All right. Let's get to one more call before the break. And I welcome Betsy in Bordertown, Pennsylvania, to Radio Times. Hello, Betsy.
Hi. I have a question. I'm probably one of the few people with landline these days. And I would be glad to answer the phone for a bona fide pollster. I can see what numbers calling in, but I honestly don't know. I guess I've never seen one that said Quinnipiac poll or whatever. Is there something I should look for, particular numbers, to know that I'm answering to somebody who is real?
All right. No, that's a good question. Thanks, Betsy. And Chris Borick.
It's a great question.
What do you say? Yeah.
From Betsy. And ours, you should, if we do call you. And by all means, please answer our call. We'll be very happy if you do. Should come up Muhlenberg College Institute of Public Opinion, or at least Muhlenberg College, on it. And I think it's probably the same for, I can't speak for Quinnipiac or Franklin and Marshall, but usually if you're calling, we call from the college location, and it comes up on our phone lines. So I think if you do have a landline and you have caller ID, you will probably see that. Now, a lot of people, so the campaigns, which are going to be polling even more than the public pollsters, are going to be out there, and they hire research firms to do there. So you might see research firm names pop up from, you know, with various tags and identities. And so you might not know exactly. You'll see that name. You'll say, that doesn't ring a bell, like perhaps Quinnipiac or Muhlenberg or Franklin or Marshall. But in our case, we hope that you see our name, and that gives you a little bit of an increased incentive to answer.
Fair enough, Chris Borick. We're looking at the art of polling this hour of Radio Times in an unpredictable election cycle. Chris Borick is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College, and Sam Wong he's founded the Princeton Election Consortium, and we're taking calls and comments at 888-477-9499, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about polling and the 2016 presidential election. Sam Wong is data analyst and neuroscience professor at Princeton University, and he is founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. And Chris Borick is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College. And the number to call is 888-477-9499 to get into the conversation, or you can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org. We're going to get into polling numbers and the media, but first, I'd like to take a call from Rich, who is in a cab in Philly, and he's been hanging on the line for quite a while. Welcome, Rich.
Hey there.
Hi.
It's Rob. How are you doing?
Well, thanks. So what's your comment or question?
The question I had in listening to your guest, because I have my own sort of survey that I do in the taxi, and sometimes I offer passengers who are particularly passionate the option of going on camera and sharing their opinions, whatever their views, because I think a lot of problems get solved in a taxi. Unfortunately, not everyone hears about it. But my question is, millennials, they're so key to this election, both the presidential and, for us, the senatorial election. Do you guys have some sort of special sauce to figure out if they're going to vote? Because I read people pretty well, and a lot of younger people get in the taxi. I don't have any idea if they're ever going to, you know, put down their cell phones long enough to go vote. Mm.
And that might, in effect, affect Hillary Clinton's candidacy. Rich,
yeah.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Chris Borick, you want to tackle that one?
Well, I do like Rich's methodology, first of all.
Grassroots polling.
That's really interesting. And I'd like to see some of his results. And it's, yeah, I don't know if it's a special sauce, per se, for millennials compared to anybody else in the population. But I go back to some of those measures, right, as you try to get a likely voter identified, how interested they are, how close are they following the election. There are also, you know, ways that we do, and we don't talk about the way we get our sample, our sample frames. How do we use, voter lists? Do we use just random dials of all possible numbers out there? So if you go to things like voter lists, you could actually see past behaviors of voters, right? Did they vote? That's public record. I don't know how people vote, but I could tell you if they voted or not. And so if you talk to those, if you look at those folks and you see a pattern, you usually could deduce some probabilities that they'll show up. It's not perfect. Millennials don't have as big of a track record individually of voting patterns because they haven't voted that much. So it gets a little harder. You don't have as many data points to look at. So we do turn to some of those interest measures and other measures to get a sense. And, it's a tricky group, and I think they are important, especially for Hillary Clinton in terms of that Obama coalition that works so well for the president and trying to maintain elements of that by keeping young voters in the fold. So really key part of this election.
Sam Wong, what do you think of social media as a platform for gauging public opinion? Northeastern political science professor Nick Beauchamp, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, apparently sampled 120 million tweets from two dozen swing states during the 2012 election and used words from these tweets via machine to, he says, accurately estimate voter intention. Is there a treasure trove of information here?
Yeah, so using innovative methods to reach voters is super interesting. One difficulty with that kind of sampling is you have to have some way of referring it to a real baseline calibration, some kind of yardstick that you can use to say, okay, this is what this thing predicts. One of the more interesting innovations in this domain has been something that a reader of my website invented, which I called Google-wide association studies, with basically looking at which search term by search term, which search terms seem to be predictive of state polls. And so the idea is to use state polls as a benchmark for what's true and then to extrapolate to other states that aren't so well surveyed. And that worked super well. So it actually worked in some states better than polling. It was really incredible. So I think the right way of using that kind of data could work. But the huge difficulty is knowing how to refer the data to some measure that is what I would call a gold standard. Mm. And right now, state polling is currently the gold standard. But, you know, maybe Beauchamp can do better someday.
Chris Bork, what do you think?
No, I agree totally with Sam. I mean, I'm intrigued by these methods, the various using social media data to try and be predictive and combine it with a number of other factors to give us prediction models. And we'll get to see, right? I think that's Sam alluded to. I mean, that's one of the great things about our industry. We have a result to validate against. And some of these models might prove to be quite successful. They don't have the long track record. They don't have the benchmarks to look to in some ways. But I think I'm absolutely intrigued about how they perform, and this year is going to give us a test, since there seems to be more than ever. There's more polls than ever, but there's also more of these alternative methods and election markets and other predictive models that are out there, and so it's going to be great to see how they perform.
Chris, I read that many online surveys, back to online surveys, don't ask questions in Spanish. Not sure how that works with landline calls. So how might this skew results among Hispanic populations?
You know, it's always when you're doing bilingual or single language non-English populations, where it's a challenge if you're not finding methods to reach those audiences in ways that they can understand. You know, I think the luck in many ways for pollsters that haven't included Spanish language interviewers in the process either or Spanish language translations in online polls is that among the voting population, first of all, Hispanic Latino Americans vote at a lower percentage, and among those that do, there is a larger portion of bilingual individuals, so they still have a a likelihood of being able to complete the survey. That doesn't mean that you're going to not have population part of the population left out. But in the past, I think it's been covered a little bit by those factors that I just mentioned.
Back to the phones. Manny in Philly, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. My question was, is there any data about how the polls themselves push people to vote one way or the other, and that results themselves changing the election?
Interesting. Sam Wong?
Oh, well, that's an interesting point. As I mentioned earlier this hour, I think the evidence is that it is not very strong in favor of polls moving opinion. I think, among other reasons, each individual poll has a certain amount of uncertainty to it. And so when things get really close, individual voters get conflicting data. And unless you're a major statistics nerd, it is hard to do things like calculate medians in your head and so on. So I think that the place where it could happen is in places where there's a landslide for one candidate or the other. Your listener is not calling from such a place. Pennsylvania is not a place where a landslide is going to happen.
Manny, thanks for the call to Radio Times. So as we kind of approach the top of the hour here, I'd like to quickly poke at media coverage. Research has shown that polling numbers can influence the coverage a candidate receives and the amount or type of coverage, which can then affect how voters perceive the candidate. So, Sam, if a candidate is getting high numbers, he or she is going to receive more media attention, which then means they are that much more in the public eye. Is this unavoidable?
I think that's pretty much unavoidable because there has to be some way to arbitrate who gets covered. I think that the deeper problem with media coverage right now, if I may, is that there's a certain post-factuality to media coverage where people get very interested in horse race coverage. And there's a Columbia journalism professor, Jeff Jarvis, who's pointed out that in the last 20, 30 years, there's been a distinct tendency to get away from talking about policies and facts and more talk about who's ahead, who's not ahead. And, you know, look, we just spent the whole hour doing it, so we're susceptible to it.
Yes, we are.
And, you know, people are interested in that. But I think there's a real difficulty with how media covers races. I think, you know, it's unavoidable that somebody like Gary Johnson or Jill Stein will get less coverage because, look, neither of them is ever going to become president. And so you know, how much oxygen should we use up on them?
If they had gotten more coverage, then perhaps one of them might be on the debate stage tonight.
Yeah, Ross Perot did pretty well without too much coverage, and he ended up doing all right. So I think that at some point candidates can reach escape velocity, more likely in states than nationwide. So I think that we should look in the future to states as a place where minor parties could make inroads in the future.
Chris, how would you like to see media use polling data?
It's a great question in the sense that I'd like to see them, as Sam alluded to, while we're infatuated with the horse race, and I could understand that. People want to know the score. They want to know who wins. They want to know who's winning and losing. I think there's such great depth in polls give us enlightenment in terms of the underlying factors that are going on, the policy questions, the demographics within the race. I'd love to see more attention to that. I do a lot of my research, non-horse race stuff, is on policy issues, climate change issues. And I think we learn so much from those type of polls. We do get fixated on horse races because, as I said before, everybody wants to know the score. And I'm, as Sam said, I'm as guilty as anybody as a producer of those things.
All right. Brittany in Philadelphia is live or standing by to go on Radio Times. You're live, Brittany. Hi.
Hey, how's it going? I wanted to make a comment on what Rich said, the taxi driver, about millennials not voting. And, you know, My friends and I were very intelligent people, and we have watched the corruption of American politics, and we are definitely going out to vote this November.
So have you been approached, or have you talked to somebody who's taking a survey regarding the election? Have they been able to get a hold of you?
No.
Are you on a cell phone?
Not. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Chris, Brittany sounds as if she's involved. She's going to vote, and she's a millennial. And you said you're on a cell phone, right, Brittany?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. And I have not gotten one phone call asking if I was going to vote. And I've talked to friends of mine too, and you know, it just doesn't seem like they're really reaching out to the millennial generation.
Yeah. Well, and again, as we talked about earlier in the show, and briefly, Chris, you can talk about the challenges regarding, you know, reaching people who are on landlines versus cell phone. It's two totally different situations. And yeah, thanks, Brittany, for the call.
Yeah, no, it's a big issue. And how we do that, there's like minor things in polling methodology that might help with a case like Brittany's, right? We stay in the field a little bit longer, and we'll call back respondents a number of times to try and get harder to reach audiences. So if, for example, on the third time we try someone compared to the first time, it'll be a different group. Well, the first time will be older. It'll be more people staying at home. If it's the people that it takes us three times to get, they're going to be different. They're often going to be younger. And the only way, again, would be is if you can call cell phones. And for groups that aren't calling cell phones, that in itself is a very, very big problem.
Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, just that the one point I think that's probably important from Brittany's perspective is that it is often the case that millennials this year are more favorable to third and fourth party candidates. If they follow the trend of past years, most of them will eventually go along with Clinton or Trump. And so that's one thing that I think is a very interesting dynamic that we have to watch in the next coming weeks. The other is that I think that she's clearly a very engaged voter. And what I would say is that probably very engaged voters in this polarized environment would do best to go places where the race is close and select those. So, for instance, in Pennsylvania, I would think that both parties would be fighting pretty hard over the 8th district of Pennsylvania, which is a congressional district that, you know, there's some chance of overturning the incumbent. And so I think that there are ways for voters to get engaged. And I would challenge Brittany to get out there and not wait at home for a call or wait on your cell phone for a call, but go make a difference for whoever is important to you. I think there are things that voters can do and, you know, show us.
Yeah. All right. Well, let me just get to a couple of comments here. I'll just read them 1, 2, 3. Email from Wiley. I'm sick of wall-to-wall coverage of polls. I find it to be a disservice to news. Polls aren't news. There's a lot going on in the world, and all you learn on the TV is nothing. And then we have an email from another listener who says, you know, people are tired of polling. Pollsters try to predict the election. It's the people's place for that. So just a quick comment. Chris Borg, how do you want people to view polls, to use polls, again, as they're kind of coming from them, perhaps from seemingly every corner?
Sure. I mean, I think it provides a better understanding of what's taking place in an election. And the comments are right. I mean, ultimately, it is the people's choice, and they're going to decide on November 8th. I think a more informed electorate on the dynamics of the race, the issues, and even to a degree the horse race gives the public some of the same insight that the candidates have on where these races are headed. So I think, in general, more information is good.
And a comment from Carol, who says, I've been called by pollsters and the questions are confusing. They spend 20 minutes asking me questions such as, are you more likely, less likely? And she finds this confusing. Are there efforts underway throughout the process to try to tweak the way people are surveyed? Chris?
Yeah, Mary, they are. I mean, I think wording is the cornerstone of our surveys and how we word them and what way we structure our questions, the order. Pollsters are always playing with that, trying to find the best way to do that, the most efficient way and the most neutral way to do that. We spend a lot of time sharing those thoughts. And one thing I'll say really quickly is you want transparency. You want to see exactly what the questions are when the public's reviewing polls. Look at the questions. Look at the order. Look at how things were constructed.
All right. And very quickly, we've got about 30 seconds left. Sam Wong, how are you? What are you going to be doing tonight as you know, with the debate? How are you going to be working with that?
I'm not going to be doing anything with data whatsoever. I'm fascinated to see what these two are going to say to each other. No audience cheering, no yelling at rallies, just the two of them stating positions. No fact-checking, which is kind of a problem. But but anyway, we get to see what they're going to say.
And Chris Borick, you're on the clock, I assume.
Yeah, I'll be doing some media, but mostly sitting in my living room in my big chair like everybody else just watching.
Chris Borick, it was a pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times. Chris Borick is professor of political science at Muhlenberg College and director of the college's Institute of Public Opinion. And Sam Wong, our thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Sam is a professor of neuroscience at Princeton University and developer of the Princeton Election Consortium. And don't forget to visit our Facebook page. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you'll find our podcasts there as well. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening to Radio Times.